And g'day, I'm Craig Sisterson, and you're listening to the Crime Time FM podcast, where we speak about that genre that we all love, crime, mystery, and thriller writing, and have great conversations with some of the best master storytellers from all around the world. And boy, oh boy, do I have a special treat for you today. All the way from down under in Australia, we have the quiet king of Australian crime writing, the gold standard of rural noir, as he has been called by the likes of Chris Hammer and Jane Harper. If you like their books, if you like Gabriel Bergmoser or Emma Stiles or any of those wonderful Outback Noir tales, he is the giant on whose shoulders they are standing. Welcome, Gary Disher.
Thanks, Craig. It sounds like a different Gary Disher, but I'll go along with it for now.
As I say, Gary's the quiet king of Australian crime writing. We call him that because he's so humble, but he's been writing for over 35 years, entertaining us with an array of wonderful stories in the crime genre and in other genres as well, literary fiction, historical, and others. But we are, of course, here to talk about his crime writing today. And for our UK and Northern Hemisphere listeners, his most recent book has just come out in paperback called Day's End, which continues the adventures and misadventures of a small-town rural constable, Paul Hirsch Hirschhausen. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the most recent book, Gary? What sparked you to write this? I know you had a break from Hirsch with The Way It Is Now, an outstanding standalone. So what brought you back to Hirsch with this book?
Well, the immediate answer is I had a contract. But I like the character, and he's still got some miles in him, I think. And I had been reading, I get a lot of my ideas from newspapers. I cut out clippings all the time. And I'd gathered many over the years about the rise of the far-right movements around the world, but also in Australia. And the federal police in Australia consider them much more dangerous than Islamic fundamentalists. They're very fearful of a lone wolf like the man who shot up the 50, killed 50 people in Christchurch in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how I was going to weave this into a Hirsch novel until I read a newspaper clipping about a far-right movement buying a rural property in outback New South Wales so that they could do their paramilitary training without being noticed by anybody. And I thought, aha, this could happen in Hirsch's neck of the woods. So that was the immediate idea for the book. I don't really explore that until the end. We don't really know what's going on. I suppose I'm giving spoilers here a little bit, but that the underlying storyline deals with that and some of the offshoot behaviour of it, including that we meet in the book. Because Hirsch is a humble constable, he hasn't got a lot of authority, but he's always has to be first on the scene if there's some sort of minor squabble or upheaval. And so he has to deal with COVID deniers and a man who goes into a medical clinic and rips the masks off the patients there because the doctor is about to give his wife a COVID injection. So as a frontline cop at that rural small town level, he has to deal with those sorts of things. So I tease the reader all the way through with these little strange outbursts of bad behaviour, and it's all linked ultimately. But the book opens with another newspaper clipping idea of a man from Denmark, I think, came to Australia looking for his son, a backpacker son. It was just a little three-page story in a newspaper, but as soon as I read it, I imagined that man's heartache. And in the book, it's a woman comes to Australia to look for her missing backpacker son, and the last she knows of it is that Hirsch is a job as a jackaroo on an outback sheep station. So Hirsch takes her out there to talk to the owners of the property. So those two storylines, there's also a body in a suitcase, and Hirsch quibs in the book, "My first body in a suitcase."
It's one of the things I love about your books, and there are so many things that readers and listeners love about your books, Gary, but one of the things I love is that you always have a lot going on, and not in a bad way. It's finely balanced. Like, it's never a single case for you, even if there's a main through line. There's always Hirsch's dealing with like lots of little kind of sometimes quite quirky and idiosyncratic little small town crimes, which are very realistic for the small towns in Australia and New Zealand, and perhaps, you know, a little bit different to kind of the village mysteries of the UK, is that our small towns in Australia and New Zealand, they have kind of a different feel, you know, because the nature is such a big part of our lives and hovers over us in different ways. There's this kind of shadow of the power of nature, and there's kind of that, there's a bit more of an edge to our small towns, it feels like, than perhaps the classic village mystery of Agatha Christie or Naya March.
Yeah, and there's the factor of distance too. Nature and distance, all those things govern the way these characters move around the landscape and can retard their movements and influence their day-to-day policing. But I don't know if one officer police stations exist in villages in the UK, but there are quite a few in rural Australia. And I like that idea of Hirsch being not having a great deal of authority, because the main characters in most crime fiction are inspectors or at least sergeants with a team working under them. But he's a lowly constable, not a lot of authority. He's also an outsider because he grew up in the city. He was part of a disgraced CIB squad in a small suburban police station, and he got bumped down to uniform and sent to one officer police station. So his job entails investigating lots of little crimes, some of which might relate to the main thread through crime, of course.
Yeah, and it's cool that there's that balance of, like you say, he's a solo officer. He's kind of a low man on the totem pole in terms of the region. He's got lots of bosses above him, and not you know, staff or helpers on his level or below. But he has that background, that detective background, that he brings a different set of skills than the typical kind of starting out constable might do in kind of rural Australia or rural New Zealand and things like that. And I do love that balance he has. I was thinking with Day's End whether the backpacker story had been ripped from the headlines, because I know that when we spoke about the way it is now, you shared how you often have those newspaper clippings and some of the newspaper stories that have inspired that fantastic standalone. But because that is something that is keenly felt by Australians and New Zealanders, I think, because we are nations that people travel a long way from to come and see. And we unfortunately have kind of tragic real life histories of backpackers who've gone missing in the bush. And our bush in Australia and New Zealand is different to each other, but they're both dangerous in different ways and provide opportunity for people of evil intent to do things as well. And with our tourism, we're obviously very heightened about, you know, visitors having bad experiences. And so, I was curious whether that had been a rip from the headlines aspect as well, because I know we have some classic missing backpacker stories in New Zealand as well. So,
yeah. But, you know, I'm a parent, and I can imagine the sense of panic and fear if my daughter were to go to Europe, for example, and disappear. I'd be racing there immediately to try and find her. So I was driven by tapping into my own feelings about that. For example, my daughter, in her gap year after university, got hospitalized in Milan with glandular fever and bad reactions to antibiotics and all those sorts of things. So I found myself flying immediately to Milan to be with her. I might snatch things from the headlines, but I'm always looking for the human aspect of it. What emotions is it touching off in me, or potentially in readers too? Because then I'm better able to explore it if I have an emotional attachment at some level to the central drama.
And I think that's so important in storytelling in general. Sometimes you hear filmmakers talk about that. You're trying to elicit emotion in the screen audience. But I think it applies equally to novelists. And we often speak, especially with genre fiction, like crime fiction, about the importance of a mystery plot line, and it's got to be twisty and compelling to keep the reader turning the pages. But I think it always comes down to the human aspects of what we see, even if it's in a crime novel, hopefully something we don't see, you know, meet serial killers in our real lives or anything like that, or come up against far-right people in the rural areas. But I think it's about identifying with the characters, the main character, our perspective viewpoint character, but also the other characters. And for you, is character the most important thing in crime fiction, regardless of having to have a good mystery plot line?
I think it is, yeah. I think you can have a novel full of the most compelling, well, they won't be compelling, the most devious twists and turns, but they won't have an impact unless they're having an impact on the character. I think the reader needs to share what the main character might be going through. Otherwise, these twists and turns will just fall flat. It all boils down to character. I think going back to the way it is now that you talked just raised, that to me is a novel about family, a fractured and fracturing family, but it's also a crime novel. And I'm often writing about people under strain, families under strain, small towns under strain. So I'm tapping into that emotional level.
Absolutely. And I guess going back a little bit, since we're talking about the Hirsch novels, and this is the fourth novel now, and we were also blessed and grateful enough to have a Hirsch short story in our groundbreaking first ever Dark Deeds Down Under anthology that came out last year, and you kindly gave us a Hirsch short story for that. So there's four novels and a short story that readers can enjoy. But going back to his first kind of appearance in Bitterwash Road, where did that character come from for you? You'd written cop characters before, series cop characters with Chalice and Destry, your series set on the Mornington Peninsula, and you'd written kind of other series characters like Wyatt, the Master Thief, and hope we'll talk about both of them later on today. But where did Hirsch come from?
From a few places. I think my publisher had suggested it's time I wrote a standalone. And I'd been feeling that too, because I'd written a series of the Peninsula police procedurals in a row, and I wanted to change from it. So when the publishers suggested a standalone, I leapt at it. But also what has happened is that I grew up in wheat and wool country in the mid-north of South Australia, halfway between Adelaide and the Flinders Ranges, about 3 hours north of Adelaide. Dry wheat and wool country is the world of the Hirsch novels. So even though I left there to go to university and hadn't returned except for Christmas to see family, the place was drawing me back. Mm. And that's happened a few times to me over the years. I wanted to go back to where I grew up in a book. Yes. So there was that. And I thought I'd like the idea of a main character who didn't have a lot of authority, who's a bit put upon, a decent guy who's a bit put upon. And I thought perhaps he could have grown up in the area, because my brother is a policeman, or retired now, and he was a country cop. He's very useful when I want to ring him up and say, Russell, is the back of the paddy wagon air conditioned or not? He's good on those sorts of issues. He's not so good on other aspects of police work, though, like my father with the Second World War, stuff he won't talk about. So I thought I might make him someone firmly rooted to the place, because a lot of crime main characters are, like, take Inspector Rebus in Edinburgh, and Hieronymus Bosch in Los Angeles. They grew up there. The place made them, and they made the place. But I thought I might get another layer or level of tension if Hirsch is an outsider. So he runs two investigations, if you like. The first investigation is, what is this place? What makes it tick? How do I fit in here? And the second investigation is into the crimes he comes upon. Mm. So that was the thinking that came in behind it. I'd also had written another newspaper article, if you like, a father and son suspected of killing the son's wife because she wanted a divorce, which would mean that the family farm would be, have to be split up and sold. And the theory was that they killed her and buried her in a mine shaft on their prop on the farm. So I took the bones of that idea too, and wove it into the story. Of course, there are other things going on.
Yeah, there's always other things going on in a Gary Disher novel. As I say, one of the things I love about it, and as you say, the first Hirsch novel where he's this big city cop who gets caught up in this corruption inquiry and effectively banished to the back blocks of wheat and wool country in South Australia and demoted to constable and kind of just left out there, basically, so he can't be too much of a nuisance. It was intended to be a standalone. And then six years later, you bring him back in peace. So what brought you back to Hirsch? What was it about his character that for you meant you wanted to keep writing about him or bring him back?
It's happened to me a few times over the years where a character has tapped me on the shoulder. Even going back to when I wrote a little short story for adults called The Bamboo Flute, based on a story my father told me that when he was a child, his only happy memories of school days was the day he took a flute along to school that he'd made himself from bamboo. The teacher praised him. The rest of the time, the teacher thrashed him with a cane. It was a short story. It won a short story prize. It was published in a literary a magazine for adult readers. But the character wouldn't leave me alone, and I turned it into a very successful novel for children. So, yeah, along the years, characters have tapped me on the shoulder, and Hirsch had more stories to tell, and I liked Hirsch, so I returned to him. And, in fact, the book I've just finished, which is coming out in the UK around maybe April, May next year, in one of the Peninsula novels, there's a young female thief, kind of a female Wyatt. She's a cat burglar. And she tapped me on the shoulder, so I've written a novel about her. And I've just been going through my editor's feedback on that. So, yeah, there's something about a character that appeals to me, and I want to return to them.
Absolutely. And I think it is, yeah, so much about people with your novels. But your novels also have an incredibly strong sense of place. And with Hirsch, it's the wheat and wool country you and your brother and that grew up in. And in other places, you know, Mornington Peninsula and sometimes the city and stuff for Wyatt as well. And how important do you think setting is in crime fiction? Because I think especially for our kind of, you know, our British listeners and elsewhere in the Northern Hemisphere, one of the things that appeals to them about Australian and New Zealand crime fiction are these faraway settings that are somewhat familiar from film and TV, but are also kind of exotic. But how important for you is setting and that sense of place? You talk about the impact that a place has on people. It kind of interrelates, I think, people and place. But I'd love to get your perspective, Gary.
I think setting should be vital in all fiction, frankly. I used to teach creative writing for about 10 years to adult students, and they very rarely paid any attention to the setting. To them, I think the setting is a static place. There's an armchair in the corner and the TV's on and the curtains are drawn. And that's enough of a stage setting to have two characters having an argument. Well, I don't think it is enough. I think writers, if I'm describing an argument or a sense of menace or tension in a place, I will choose aspects of that setting and highlight them in some way, describe them in a particular way to encourage this sense of menace and tension. Because settings are always dynamic. They're not static. That they affect the character, they can affect the mood of the scene and so on. And I think it's vital in crime fiction. When I'm writing, I pay attention to two types of settings. Small domestic settings, even a bedroom, the main character's bedroom, or in the Hirsch case, often I'm describing the office. The police station is, in fact, a cottage on a road on the main highway. The front room is the police station. The back of the building is where he lives. So I'm often describing the office as well as the broader, wider landscape. they're equally important to me in when I'm writing. I learned early in my writing career, I won a creative writing scholarship to Stanford University in California, and I gave a short story to be workshopped, and it was pulled apart by the class, and about a young woman going into a pub, seeing her old boyfriend there, and she decides by the end of the story, no, she's finished with him, she's not going to talk to him, she's moved on. So that's all you need in a story like that. You don't need a car chase. And but the class pulled the story apart, and someone said, your writing suffers from sensory deprivation. And I was quite crushed, but I asked her what she meant, and she said that good writing makes pictures in the head, and one way of doing that is to appeal to the reader's senses. So when I'm describing a setting, I try to get the reader to smell the dust in the air, for example, to see a shift in the light quality, to hear the distant cry of a bird or whatever, or driving on a gravel road to hear the little pebbles ping under the chassis of the car. I think it helps to bring the reader into the scene. I think that sort of writing can it can enrich all kinds of writing, of course, poetry, nonfiction, but I think it's pretty vital in fiction. So the setting really matters to me. It can reflect on the characters. It can even influence the plot. For example, to use a obvious sounding one, Hirsch is chasing the bad guy and he gets cut off by a bushfire. So the setting is always, in my mind, a dynamic element in fiction writing.
I love that thought of it being a dynamic element rather than a static background. You know, it's not a two-dimensional, you know, stage, you know, and a Shakespeare play behind the characters.
Yeah.
It's this moving, the setting is this moving, living thing. I love the way you always make me think about things when I get to chat to you, Gary, as well. You have that teacher in you, whereas I always feel like I'm learning, you know, which is great when I'm talking to you. And listeners, you can't see, though, maybe you can hear it in my voice, but I've been grinning along the last few minutes as Gary has been speaking, because what he doesn't know is that I actually use excerpts from his Hirsch novels in my guest lectures on setting and a writing an online writing academy in Australia. I actually use some excerpts from Gary and Michael Connolly, Sean Cosby, Jane Harper, Vander Simon, and some other authors to show the different ways that you can evoke a strong sense of place. And and I've used some of the Hirsch novel excerpts, a page or two, for the students to read and see how you do that so well. So that's one of the reasons I've been grinning away here while he's been talking, because he is a master of setting as well as character. You've spoken a little bit about the short stories, you know, your short story in Stanford, your short story, The Bamboo Flute. You did a lovely short story about Hirsch for us with Dark Deeds Down Under. For you, what's the difference between writing a short story and writing a novel? Because they are different forms. Is the writing the same for you, or do you have to think about them differently given the length?
I think about them differently. In recent years, I haven't written many short stories at all, basically because I can't afford to. I was getting to the point where it was taking me several weeks to write a short story, and the best I could hope for was a free copy of the literary magazine that published it. And I couldn't make a living like that, because that's all I do for the last few decades is write. Mm. But I think stories... To me, a fine short story, like the ones we read from, say, the Canadian writer Alice Munro or the Anglo-Irish writer William Trevor, they're both my favourites of short story writers, Ron Rush, the American writer, I think they work on the level of compression and inference. Nothing's quite spelt out. We read between the lines much more. They usually have a shorter time frame, a tighter sense of place, etc., fewer characters and so on. They're the obvious defining aspects, but and a novel is a much more relaxed a novel can still be very tight, but it's you do have the room to explore a bit more. Whereas in short stories, it often works on the level of suggestion.
When you get an idea in your head, or when a character starts speaking to you again, do you kind of immediately know what form that might take, whether it'll be a novel or a short story or perhaps a radio play or something else? You've written various things. Or do you kind of work it out as you go, or is it kind of pretty clear pretty early on what shape the story
might take? These days it's usually pretty clear early on that I'm working in the novel form. I have a couple of other ideas that are not crime based, and I see them as novellas. Usually I'm thinking in terms of novels these days.
Absolutely. Now, I was thinking when you're speaking about short stories, I remember when I was at high school in New Zealand in the 90s, and I had an American teacher for a couple of years who was over there, and they introduced us to kind of short stories, because we'd read novels, or we'd do the round robin Shakespeare reading as you did in high school English, where everyone's a character and everyone thinks it's boring because half the class can't read what they're trying to say. But I remember the short story, and it still sticks out to me, 25, 30 years later, and reading The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. I still remember that story 30 years ago. We read several. There was another one that stuck out to me, not quite to the same extent as The Lottery. I think it was The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell as well, which was another one, which went by another title, which is basically, humans getting hunted on an island kind of thing, like that, instead of tigers or lions. But that kind of showed me how powerful and the kind of emotions that could be drawn out in just a few short pages. But I would imagine that you try and bring those kind of that sense of emotion and power to novels as well. Now, we've spoken a bit about Hirsch, who's your kind of most recent series character. I do want to go back, not quite to the beginning, because you wrote a variety of other novels first in the late 80s and early 90s. But kind of at the start of the 90s, you introduced us to a really fascinating crime fiction hero, quote unquote, kind of less common in detective fiction to be a series character of Wyatt, a master thief, whose kind of job almost makes him an anti-hero, but he's the kind of the hero or the protagonist of what became an outstanding series. So, and I believe, I think it was a Kickback, if I'm right, was your first crime novel. The first Wyatt novel was your first crime novel, after some other kind of general fiction, historical fiction, literary fiction, etc. So what inspired Wyatt? And did you know when you were doing that, you're kind of exploring in this new to you genre as a writer then, though I imagine you've read plenty of crime fiction, and you've ended up doing a lot of crime since then. But so what inspired you to write that first crime novel with Wyatt?
A few things. I think I've always read crime fiction. And I was starting to feel a bit restless with the so-called literary short stories and a couple of literary novels. I thought I'd like, because I love reading them so much, I'd like to write one. I think we all work within a tradition. There's the Californian private eye tradition, for example, or whatever it might be. And I had been reading a lot of the American writer Richard Stark, whose main character is an anti-hero called Parker. Wyatt, he robs banks and payroll vans, but I knew I didn't want to be a slave to his method, or I didn't want to copy him. Wyatt had to be my character, but I took his idea of a novel through the point of view. I also take the reader into the minds of some of the other characters, but he's the filter really for the reader. The major robberies that he puts together and the people he has to rely on who inevitably let him down in some way or betray him. They're caper novels, I suppose. Probably totally unrealistic because the big money for a crim is probably in drugs and things like that. But I didn't know if I could make a drug dealer. I couldn't do a Breaking Bad and make the TV show, make an appealing drug dealer, I didn't think. So he's an old-style crim. He robs banks and payroll vans. And I wrote six of them one a year in the 1990s, then I had a break and written three more in more recent years. They're fun to write. The first one, I've been using the first person a lot in my other fiction. And I thought, and a lot of crime fiction is written in the first person, particularly Private Eye novels. And I tried that a chill came off the page because Wyatt is a very buttoned down, merciless sort of character. He doesn't have much of an inner life. That's part of his appeal, I think, for readers. But he won't hesitate to kill if he feels threatened or if he's betrayed or whatever it might be. So I couldn't write him in the first person. It wasn't working. So I made it the multiple third person. So it removed me from him sufficiently to be able to write about him. Yeah. But I had, also another thing that happened, writers often divide themselves between seat of the pants writers and planners. And I was a seat of the pants writer with my early couple of novels and short stories. The Irish writer Seán O'Phalen mentions if you have three elements at the start, a character, a situation, and a promise, a promise for the reader and the writer of it's going somewhere, that something's going to be explained. That's basically what I would do with those early stories and novels. It was a voyage of discovery, and I tried that same method with the Wyatt novel, and it was doomed to failure. I realized that in a crime novel, I needed to stay a step ahead of the reader in various ways. All writers do need to stay a step ahead of the reader, but it's more crucial in some ways with a crime novel. And I was relying too much on coincidence and big tests that writers have to ask themselves, will the reader buy this? And the reader would not have bought any of that early Wyatt. So I became a planner, basically. Now I plan in minute detail, spending several weeks, sometimes two or three months, planning. I'm not a slave to the plan. I always listen to that voice in the back of my head that tells me she wouldn't do that or this is not working. So I will not necessarily jettison the plan, but I'll tweak it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I've had the pleasure and privilege of interviewing a few hundred crime writers over the last 15 years for podcasts and magazines, on stage at festivals and things like that. And it is such a spectrum, even within the crime fiction community, between plotters and pantsers and a spectrum in between, from someone like, I know Jeffrey Deaver writes 100-plus page plan. Other people do the kind of screenwriting thing of bullet points of a few pages, kind of like a screenwriting beat sheet. And then, you know, another great Irish writer, Liz Nugent, who writes psychological thrillers and wins several awards, she's a complete pantser. And I think the way she described it to me is she has her characters at the start reacting to a traumatic situation. Like, she drops readers in when the characters have just, something bad has just happened. And so that kind of kickstarts the story. Or Michael Connelly, the fantastic author of the Hieronymus Bosch series and Mickey Heller series, et cetera, as well, Lincoln Lawyer. He's more of a headlights at night, I think he describes it, as he often kind of knows where he wants to end up, but he only can see a little bit in front of himself. He doesn't know the whole road. So it's like driving at night, where you can just see a little bit in front of you, but you kind of know where you're going. You know, kind of thing, or you want to.
Yeah, so I think James Lee Burke said that too. James Lee Burke said he never sees more than a couple of pages or a couple of chapters ahead. Tony Hillerman, I read the late Tony Hillerman, that he didn't really know until the end what the main crime was or who committed it or why or how to resolve it. Where P.D. James would spend 18 months planning, then 18 months writing. So there's no right or wrong, but it's... I now know that I'm a planner.
Yeah. And do you plan it out the whole way to the end? So you know who the killer is, or you know why they did it. So you have quite a detailed plan, kind of thing, at least.
I have the broad story arc, and then I gradually, over several weeks, break it into chapters. So a lot of tweaking goes on.
Of course. And I was curious, we've seen recently, like Jane Harper's books with The Dry that have come, you know, to come to the screen. I believe Chris Hammer's series with Scrublands is coming out very soon. If not, it may have just started in Australia. And we're seeing kind of hopefully more and more with the streaming services of crime fiction and Australian and New Zealand crime fiction being picked up. Have there been any nibbles? Is there anything you may or may not be able to tell us? Obviously, I understand contractually, but have there been any moves over the years to perhaps bring some of your books to the screen?
Yeah, there have, but I'm a bit cynical about it. I've had meetings with filmmakers who promise great things and option the books, and nothing happens. But just lately, there has been someone's interested in Bitter Wash Road, the first Hirsch novel. Another person's interested in Wyatt. So fingers crossed. And I'd like to be in the crowd scene. I'd love it if they were filmed. The late Peter Corris, the Sydney crime writer, he said, what you do is you take the money and run, because the finished product won't necessarily resemble your book. As long as they don't make Wyatt a cheeky larrikin next door with a glint in his eye, Wyatt is a cold, buttoned-down character, and he needs to stay like that.
Yeah, it's interesting, because they are different storytelling forms, and I think as when I was growing up as a reader, I was always incredibly frustrated more often than not if a favourite book became a TV series or a movie, because they have to change it. They can't fit a 300-page, 400-page book into a 90-minute, two-hour movie. It's a little bit different now with streaming, where you have these 4 and 6 and 8 and 10-part television series. So there is a little bit more scope. So I think more and more readers are more satisfied with the translations of their favourite tales to screen. But it is still a different form. And it does get frustrating if seemingly unnecessarily the changes are made. You know, you obviously can't have the inner thoughts of the character like you would have in a book. You'd have to portray those things in a different way. It's a different form, sight and sound. But yeah, we all have our issues with 5'5" Jack Reachers and other things. to make it believable. Yeah. We don't want the character change too much along the way. And the great Michael Connelly, who we've both spoken about a little bit, I know that he's had the full spectrum of experiences from taking the money and having nothing to do with it and being mixed feelings about the result, to with his most recent Bosch and Lincoln Lawyer streaming series, he's in the writer's room, he's actually writing episodes. So he's much more heavily involved. You've written in different ways, in different forms. Could you ever see yourself doing some screenwriting yourself? Would you want to, if one of your, say the Hirsch novels, which is your most recent kind of thing, would you want to be involved or would you rather be hands-off? If it came to that,
I'd rather be hands off. I'd quite happily sit in a planning session, a meeting where screenwriters and producers sit, as I understand it, they sit around and brainstorm sometimes. I'd happily take part in that, but it's taken me my whole life to learn how to write novels, if you know what I mean. I can't change gears now and start writing scripts. It's different kind of thinking, different kind of writing. It would make me anxious. I don't want to do it.
No, I fully understand. And as you say, you've been writing novels for kind of coming up 40 years now. It's like over 35 years published, but obviously you were probably writing a little bit before you got published as well. The first times. And for you, when you sit down at your desk to write, like when you're writing this most recent kind of standalone novel about the side character from the Chalice and Destry books, you know, the next standalone. Is the excitement the same? Is what you, or maybe excitement's not the right word, is what you love about writing now the same as when you were kind of starting out with, you know, no books under your belt or a few books under your belt? Or has it evolved and the things you enjoy are different nowadays?
The sense of anticipation is still very strong. I'm getting better at it. I know when things are going wrong now. I'm a better rewriter. I'm a better editor. I don't get into the same sort of strife quite so often anymore. And so I'm getting better at it. But the sense of anticipation of getting the story down and feeling satisfied by it, that's still strong. If it was never strong again, I would stop writing, I think.
You say you get tapped on the shoulder by various characters. You have a lot of characters nowadays, like four major series characters, because there's a duo, yeah. and the morning and the Peninsula series, and lots of side characters. So are you kind of regularly getting shoulder tapped by my voices, and some of them you've got to say, no, it's not your turn yet, kind of thing?
That has happened a bit, yeah. For example, one of my recent standalones hasn't been published in the UK, called Under the Cold Bright Lights, and it's about a cold case cop. But again, it grew out of a newspaper clipping. The Victoria Police in Melbourne decided to bring back recently retired detectives to work cold cases to free up the younger detectives for the pavement pounding of that sort of detective work. And as soon as I read that, I saw my main character. He's in his late 50s. He's burnt out. He's got a long record in the police department, in the police. But now he's just burnt out. He's retired. He's tried online dating and that hasn't worked. He's joined University of the Third Age and that's bored him. He's gone on trips. They've been a big failure. So he's relieved to be brought back into the police force to work cold cases. But, of course, the young hotshot detectives call him a retread. And so as soon as I read the article, there was my main character in my head. I could see him. I'd like to write about him again, I think. I'm very interested in cold cases. I've got lots of clippings over the years about cold cases and how they're starting to be solved now with advances in DNA and so on.
I was just thinking, I actually have that book. I'm lucky enough to have that book on my shelf. I haven't been with my Australian New Zealand connections. So even though it has not yet been published in the UK, knock, knock to Viper Books there, so who are your great UK publisher, they may want to bring that one out too. I do have that one, and I was just checking. And it was, I believe it was published in 2017. So it's that you might be getting the 6-year itch again that you got with her.
Yes.
It was not quite the seven year itch, the 6-year itch of Gary Disher. 6 years to bring Hirsch back, and maybe six, or we might have to wait a year or two longer, maybe 7 or 8 years for that character to come back as well. Yeah. Can we expect more Hirsch novels in future? Do you still see more stories? Spoiler alert, guys, he doesn't die at the end of Day's End. But you could always prequel him even if he did. But could you see yourself writing more Hirsch novels?
Yeah, just started scratching my head over the next one. I've got a contract for it. I wanted to write another one anyway. So I'm just at that planning stage. So it'll be a few weeks of just looking at all my old clippings, thinking about how I can keep this novel fresh so it's not just a repeat of the others. So there's the sorts of questions I'm asking myself at this stage.
And I'm curious, just from a process standpoint, you talk about these clippings, like do you have is it on your laptop, or do you actually have an old school scrapbook where you keep newspaper clippings and stuff like that?
It's very old. Yeah, very old school, the actual newspaper clippings, yeah.
I think
I'm not very good at
following. It's tangible, it's more tangible than reading on screen. So.
And I think that's perhaps too why I write longhand. All my first drafts are longhand. I think writers are superstitious. It has to be a blue biro, blue ink pen. And I write on the backs of old manuscript pages. But then often in the afternoon or after a few days have gone by, I'll then type up what I've written. And that by then it's the second draft, if you like, because I'm editing as I go along, as I type up. But there's something about using the link between my brain and my fingers. It means that I write with a pen, and I like to read actual clippings from newspapers.
And kind of having trained myself to be a journalist, I began as a lawyer, but I'd always written. I've kind of trained myself to type directly onto the computer. I used to do all my journalism longhand and then type it up. But also, you kind of train yourself to write anywhere. You know, take your laptop and write on the train if you have to. Things like
that.
Can you write anywhere, or do you have a particular writing space, or do you find yourself like sitting down at the beach on Mornington Peninsula handwriting?
Oh, no, I couldn't write anywhere but at home, at my desk. Yeah, I can't imagine writing anywhere else.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, oh, geez, time's flying. I've just quickly looked at the clock there. It's always great talking to you, Gary. I always feel like I'm learning so much. I guess just to tie up at the end, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Australian crime writing community, because it does, I mean, you've been involved, obviously, for kind of 30 years now, and you were writing crime fiction before the Australian Crime Writers Association even existed in the mid-1990s. You've received the Lifetime Achievement Award. You're someone who a lot of Australian writers I talk to look up to, and some have publicly spoken about that, like Chris Hammer and others have just, you know, told me off the record how much they admire your writing. But for you, what's it been like to see that growth in Australian crime fiction? Because, you know, a lot of Australian and New Zealand authors, similar for Canada and Ireland, or, you know, authors from there, are often told not to set their books where they're from, because readers want books from the US or UK, because that was where the majority of English language crime writing came from. And I know even the great Michael Rabotham was told only 10 years ago or so not to set a book, not to set a book in Australia, because, you know, the marketing arm of his publishers were concerned. But you've always set your books in Australia, and you've seen the boom with the likes of Jane Harper and Chris Hammer and Gabriel Bergmesser and others getting published overseas now, with books set in Australia. What's that been like for you as an author to kind of see that happening and see this kind of strong growth? You were recently a guest of honour at Terra Australis, or I think they called it Tassie Vice this year in Tasmania, the Tasmanian Crime Writing Festival. What's it been like to see that growth of Australian crime fiction locally and globally?
It's been very encouraging because, yeah, when I started, there's always been some Australian crime writing and some Australians published. I think we owe a great debt to Peter Corris, who steadfastly set all his PI novels in Sydney, and one of them was made into a film. And so bit by bit, Australians were embracing their own literature in their own country. There was a bit of a cultural cringe, I think, early on. If it's Australian, it couldn't possibly be good enough, but that no longer applies. Because crime fiction is my favourite genre as a reader, it matters at that level too. It's meant that at all literary festivals now, crime writing panels are very, very popular. Very early on, about 20 years ago, when the Melbourne Writers Festival, it was called the Spoleto Festival back then, I was on the organising committee, and I suggested, why don't we have Peter Corris? And everyone was horrified. Crime writing, that's junk writing. That's bad writing. This is a literary festival. All those old ideas are gone now. So that's encouraging too. So crime panels at writers' festivals are really, really popular now. And I think it's recognised that crime fiction isn't junk fiction. A lot of it is, of course, but that it tells us about the world we live in, that it explores character, that these are novels that happen to be about crime, driven by a crime perhaps, but that they're worthwhile novels to begin with.
Yeah, I love you say that. You say that, Gary. That's something I've been banging the drum for in New Zealand and around the world for the last 15 years myself, and you've obviously been involved a lot longer, and I think... Yeah. It's great to see, and we're seeing more writers from other genres, more young writers come in, more Indigenous writers and writers of colour, and seeing a place for them in crime fiction.
Yeah.
It's all long overdue, but it is fantastic to see. I wish we could keep talking for hours, Gary, but we'll have to wrap it up, or Paul, my producer, is going to stage hook me off the podcast in a second. I guess just to finish up, something we like to do, and you do say you're a great crime reader as well. Do you just want to give us a little shout out to some books you've enjoyed this year, some authors you think you want to shine a light on, some crime fiction authors, whether they're Australian or otherwise, that you think our listeners should give a go?
The main one would be Mick Herron. I love his books, and I've just been rereading all of them and catching up on ones that I hadn't read before, because he writes not only that Slow House series of spy novels, but as a private eye character he returns to. He ranks high for me. Michael Connelly always has. Ian Rankin always has too. They're the main ones.
Yeah, there's something fantastic about them. And like, I kind of see you a little bit like Ian and Michael in that, is that your crime fiction is so well-rounded. It has great characters, great setting, great mysteries, underlying themes. Sometimes you get authors who are great with the action, or they're great with the setting. But I love that all of you gentlemen kind of have this really, I don't want to say holistic is not necessarily the right word, but kind of a holistic crime writing style where all of those elements are to the fore. Well, it's been absolutely wonderful. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as I have with the great Gary Disher. Make sure you go out and read his books. Thanks to the wonderful Viper Books in the UK. His books are more widely available in the Northern Hemisphere now, the most recent Hirsch series, but also the outstanding standalone The Way It Is Now. But dig back into the backlist too. It's a treasure trove of storytelling excellence. Thank you so much for being with us, Gary.
Thanks very much, Kerry.